Hello, everybody. Okay, great. I'll just start by introducing myself, if you don't already know who I am, because I've been splashed about on web pages, partly because of Cynthia Enloe coming here, so it's good news to have Cynthia here. It ups my profile on the LSE web pages. So I'm Marcia Henry, and I am the deputy director of the recently established Center for Women, Peace, and Security here at LSE, but I'm also associate professor in the Gender Institute here. So, but today I'm wearing my Women, Peace, and Security hat, and I'm delighted that the first of our conversations series for the Women, Peace, and Security Center is going to be with Cynthia Enloe. I feel a bit remiss to actually do an introduction, because how do you really introduce Cynthia Enloe? So I'm going to mention a couple of things in case you don't know Cynthia's work. But Cynthia is research professor in the Department of International Development, Community, and Environment at Clark University in Massachusetts. And Professor Enloe's feminist teaching and research have focused on, amongst other things, the interplay of gendered politics in the national and international arena, with special attention to how women's labor is made cheap in globalized factories and how women's emotional and physical labor has been used to support many governments' war-waging policies, and how diverse women have tried to resist both of these efforts. Racial, class, ethnic, and national identities, as well as pressures shaping ideas about femininities and masculinities, are common threads throughout her studies. So her 14 books include Maneuvers, The International Politics of Militarizing Women's Lives, 2004, The Curious Feminist, 2004, and Globalization and Militarism, 2007, as well as Nemo's War, Emma's War, Making Feminist Sense of the Iraq War, 2011, The Real State of America, Mapping the Myths and Truths about the United States, co-authored with Professor Joni Seeger, 2012, Seriously, Investigating Crashes and Crises as If Women Mattered, 2013. Her new, totally updated and revised second edition of Bananas, Beaches, and Bases was published by the University of California Press in 2014. If you haven't read any of those, I instruct you to go to the library. I know people don't go to the library anymore. Go to the library right after this talk, and you won't be disappointed. So I'm going to, the format of today is that I'm going to ask Cynthia a couple of questions in relation to the Center for Women, Peace, and Security. And we're going to have a bit of a conversation about some of the issues raised by the Women, Peace, and Security agenda. And then I'm going to turn over to the audience for you to ask questions of Cynthia as well. We're going to end a little bit early, so if those of you who have brought Cynthia Enloe books with you, Cynthia will gladly sign them. So we'll do that at 10 minutes to 2. Okay? Great, thank you. Okay, well, I want to start by asking you, Cynthia, in your own research and writing, you have always centered women as gendered subjects and gender relations as central to understanding conflict, war, and security concerns. So what do you think about the title of our center, the Center for Women, Peace, and Security?
Yeah, it's, well, first of all, hi. Hi, it's great to be here. It's great to be at the almost launch of the new center. I think that's very exciting. We should celebrate everything that is launched in, you know, feminist spirit. The Women, Peace, and Security name, of course, harkens, and I know this was quite deliberate, it harkens to a whole international movement now to try and make women and curiosity about women and seriousness about all kinds of women make it central to any discussion of security. And security is now so militarized, and what hopefully, and you will do this, I know, by the way, I've read Marcia's work for years, so you know, we know each other's stuff here. But what women, it's women, comma, but it's really women's eyes on security. And what does security have to do with peace? So when you see those commas, I think, the commas are where all the really rich analytical thinking is. There is also a danger, I mean, it's a danger you all know, and that is that women, peace, and security, which is usually said women, peace, and security, as if, oh, well, we always put those three things together. Well, in fact, until 2000, nobody put them together, right? So it's a very radical threesome, right, to be put together. And those commas are very energetic, active, investigatory commas. They are not simply grammatical because they say that you cannot understand security and the lack of it unless you take women's lives seriously. It says if you don't take women's lives seriously in trying to understand security, you'll never have a sustainable peace. But the risk is, and it's a risk I know that you and Zoe and Christine all know, and that is the risk is it's become bureaucratized within not just the United Nations, which now has a women, peace, and security agenda, but also out there in the world of NGOs and international organizations and even foreign policy institutions, because it's now on the international agenda. So my guess is that you're going to have to constantly, and the center will have to constantly remind people of how innovative, risky, and at times irreverent it is to put those three things together. Because otherwise, it'll sound like you're just doing what now for some people who have no historical memory, which is a lot of people, these last 15 years sound like the last three millennia. And therefore, they won't realize how radical it was to put it together and how radical it is to now have it together. Great. So it's a very interesting moment in history to launch a center that, in fact, is going to be innovative.
Thank you. I wish you'd been at the earlier meetings where we were justifying the title, because I think you put it very eloquently there. Okay, well, this is partly linked to one of the reasons why the center, one of the motivations for the establishment of the center. Last year, you know, in 2014, the UK hosted the Ending Sexual Violence and Conflict Summit. And the establishment of the center was partly in response to this. I mean, what do you think are the, you know, that obviously put a very large sort of magnifying glass on sexual violence in conflict. What do you think are the issues that a center like ours should be engaging with, should be prioritizing?
Well, you know, it's really interesting, Marcia. Sexual violence, well, I've heard it said, well, by some of the people you and I both work with, that sexual violence is too much at the center of people's imagining of what it means to talk about women's relationship to peace, women's relationship to security, that it's kind of been pushed to center stage, and now it's kind of swallowed up the stage, and makes it harder to talk about women's relationships to the militarization of food, or women's relationship to the militarization of policing, all these things that really need to be talked about. But I was just asked to go down to Bogota, to Colombia, and I've come, every place you and I go, we get educated. I mean, it is the reason, you know, to go. Supposedly one goes to, you know, talk, but in fact, it's all about listening, right? And I've now got kind of a different thought about this. And coming back to the summit and so on, I was in Sweden when the summit was going on, and there were some at a big Nordic women's forum, which was fabulous. And it was interesting because some people came directly from the London summit to the Nordic Women's Forum. And so there was a conversation that went on in Sweden as a result of them being timed so closely together. But coming back from Colombia just now, I was with a group called Humanas, which is a feminist Colombian group, Humanas. And they have worked really hard in the midst of terrible violence in Colombia to put sexual violence on anybody's agenda. So while maybe it's about privilege, right? So meaning maybe it's about the privilege of people who are doing their thinking and their strategizing in London or in Boston or in New York or in Tokyo. Maybe it's privilege that thinks, oh, everybody's talking about sexual violence now. You know, let's make sure it doesn't, you know, consume all the air in the room. That's a good caveat. But coming back from listening to the Colombian feminists, I realized it is really, really hard to get it on anybody's agenda, even to get it spoken out loud. Because what the Colombian women said, and I'll talk about this a bit more, I think, probably in the Millennium Conference on Saturday. But what the Colombian women said is they've now got it on the peace negotiators' agenda in Havana. Havana is where the Colombian government and the FARC, which is the main rebel group, that's where they're holding their negotiations. In year three now, it's a three-year-long process. And they said, we got it on to the peace agreement agenda, much to everybody's amazement and discomfort, because the women in Colombia, mainly rural women, who have been living with paramilitaries and with rebel groups and with the Colombian military, who've been sexually assaulted, they don't want to talk about it. It is so, I mean, we all know this, thinking about feminism and silence. It's so shameful. And, of course, they get blamed as well. So the people, women who've been assaulted, don't want to talk about it. And the people who are around the mainly male table in Havana, they don't want to talk about it because they don't want to admit that anybody they're responsible for is the perpetrator. So here in this one peace negotiation, it's considered a major, astounding breakthrough to get, in English, sexual violence on the peace agreement formal discussion. And it's not going to be given impunity, which is really amazing. So I would say keep the center kind of investigating where, maybe that's the question, where is it so hard to get it on anybody's public discussion table? And where is it now broken through and how? And that would be a really good investigatory question. I mean, Allison here, who's a specialist on Rwanda, could probably tell us, well, how did it manage after immediate silences to get on to the discussion in Rwanda? So that would be one way to tackle it, is make it problematic and stir up comparative discussions. Then the other thing is to say, well, who are those people who think it's the only thing to talk about? Because what then happens is that women then are placed in the position of only being the assaulted, only the ones who, under 1325, need protection. And we all know that if you make women primarily the protected, you sustain patriarchy. That's us patriarchy. So on the one hand, it is really hard to get anyone to take responsibility for that kind of protection, that kind of prevention is really hard. But once you've done it, it leaves women where patriarchal people would like them, which is they are the protected. And then the other thing is to say, well, what is the relationship between, and this is the center's great opportunity, I think, what is the relationship between women being the targets of sexual assault and all the other things that make women's lives so insecure, rather than saying, well, there's this box and that box. What are the flowing rivers of abuse and oppression and marginalization that are flowing between sexual assault and every other kind of gendered insecurity? And that might be a way to really open up discussions amongst people who think they can just stay in one channel.
Thanks so much, yeah. Cynthia.
Yeah, it's always easy to dream of things for other people to do.
And it's great to get your insight. These are all the issues that we're struggling with, students are struggling with in class.
Good.
What to do, you know, what to study, what to write their essays on, what to write their dissertations on, what kind of work they want to go into afterwards.
I think absolutely.
A lot of this is very
you.
Relevant.
We do need you.
So it's great to hear about these. Okay, so... At the summit itself, and at many events concerned with women, peace, mm-hmm. and security, there is often this glaring absence of one particular discussion, something that you know about because you've spent a long time trying to get this issue onto every agenda mm-hmm. possible. That's the gendered effects of militarization as a mm-hmm. process. And do you think that... the absence of this discussion of militarization and its negative effects is a deliberate feminist strategy, that it's a political strategy to leave that analysis and that discussion to the side so that issues like sexual violence and conflict can be focused on for a moment? Or do you think it's that we're not, that some arenas are really just not critical enough of the military, and we can't go down that road?
Yeah, or that people think that militarization is about the military. Mm. And it's Marcia and I have talked about this. Most of the people in the world who are militarized are civilians, because militarization is what goes on in your head, right? If you think that your tax dollars should go to the military, and therefore you vote for a candidate who seems very strong on a militarized notion of foreign policy, that's you, the voter, who's been militarized. It's, you know, the military can't fund itself. Well, there's some militaries that do fund themselves. That's also very, but that's about, you know, it's about mining and about land. And so that's one thing. It depends what arena you're in, isn't it? If you are trying to get the military, and I'm talking about state uniformed militaries now, that military, that kind of military, if you're trying to get them on board to a host, or maybe just two, efforts that you really think are urgent, you are likely not to talk about militarization. But you cannot stop talking about its processes and its effects, even if you don't use the M word, right? There's some people who are very, I mean, really superb women's rights activists who really have never had a chance to hone their skills in any kind of analysis of militarization, right? I mean, you do it, so you know. You can remember when you couldn't do it, right? Right. So it's like tap dancing, right? It's not as if I'm a big Fred Astaire fan, right? I love tap dancing. I think it's just, you don't even want to know. I couldn't stand up and all of a sudden tap dance just because I love tap dancing. But people actually think that they can do a gender analysis of militarism because they're good people. But it's a skill. It's a skill you've got to collaboratively hone with other people and then try it out. And I think a lot of people who work on gender and its relationship to peace and that's relationship to security and insecurity, I don't think they know how to do it. So they leave it off because it really feels quite alien. It really feels quite like unfamiliar territory, and they're afraid that they'll sound naive, or they're afraid they'll sound ignorant, or just sound, you know, untutored. So there are both those reasons, both the kind of strategic reason and the unlearned reason. I think the other thing is that a lot of people really do confuse militarization with militaries. And so they think that they've got to know something about some state's military, or maybe several states' military, to talk about militarization, where it's really about culture and popular. If you're an investigator, an observer, and curious about the ways in which ideas about masculinities and ideas about femininities either fuel or resist processes of militarization, you are a cultural analyst. Sometimes discourse analyst, sometimes a cinema analyst, sometimes a public policy discourse analyst. And so you have a lot of skills, and sometimes those aren't brought to bear, I think.
I mean, I think that's a really important point that you raised, which I think it, you know, inspires me in my teaching, because your famous article, "How Do You Militarize a Can of Soup?" is really about also empowering.
I got that in London. That
can of soup.
I remember it was some small market up towards Houston, I think.
Yeah.
And it was on a shelf, and it was Heinz. Marketed here.
Well, I think one of the interesting things is that for me, that article and that kind of analysis is very inspiring, because it means that you don't have to be a military expert.
Right.
You don't have to have been inside the military. You only needed to have lived a small amount. And you can start from the everyday object.
Right.
And so, and that is very much inspired by feminist standpoint.
Absolutely.
Thinking, for example, which was obviously a big influence in your work. So I like the idea that, you know, that actually critiques of militarism, or in engagement with militarism as an ideology and militarization as a process, doesn't have to originate from a place of sort of academic expertise,
you know,
or techno-strategic.
This is great, Marcia, because one of the assignments I give in seminars on gender and militarization is ask. I love this assignment because I love the assignment because of what I learn about when people do the assignment. Go out. Now, this is in Worcester, Massachusetts, which is it's a deindustrialized town, right, about an hour outside of Boston. And I give about 2-3 weeks, not too long. Go and study anything you think is militarized anywhere in Worcester, your daily life, if you go home, any place. And one of my favorites, all kinds of stuff comes back. It's just fabulous. A lot about who's in, statues of whom in what pose are around the city. That's always a fave. But one, a young woman in the class had been a longtime gymnast, and so she was very active in girls' gymnastic training in Worcester. So she went to her usual gymnastic girls' training, young girls' gymnastics class, and she wrote this whole paper about the militarization of girls' gymnastics. It was fab. It was fab. It was all about the drills and about the regimentation and about policing girls' bodies. But then, this is the U.S. now, it must have been the Olympics coming up. So she said there was all this kind of red, white, and blue stuff all over the gymnastics room, and there was an American flag and kind of a celebration of the American girls' entry into the Olympics. And so she wrote this whole thing about them. She was appalled. She didn't know whether she could continue gymnastics, but because she looked at it with fresh eyes. And she, now, you know, on the scale, you know, I mean, she wasn't studying drone bombers, but she said, but in these girls' lives, what are they being encouraged to imagine is success? What are they imagining is motivation? What are they imagining is their relationship to the nation. I thought that, wow. I thought that was great. And there were 15 of these papers. They were fabulous.
That's actually kind of a fascinating story because in a way you think, initially you think gymnastics, you know, is that militarization analysis gone too far?
Yeah.
But actually I have my own personal memories of watching Nadia Comaneci.
Yes, of course.
For example, we're all about really the Cold War experience of watching, you know, the sort of the enemy states participating in these gymnastics.
And
so
winning.
Actually, so much about your gender identity is formed through these national displays. So
absolutely.
I think she was onto something.
Yeah.
okay, so you know this because you know all the Cynthias who work on war and conflict.
We're talking about Cynthia Coburn now.
But Cynthia Coburn, you know, recently, not so recently, but recently for me and you probably, wrote that gender relations are causal in militarization and war. What do you think about this thesis, this provocative thesis?
I think it's what makes a feminist.
Yeah.
I mean, as feminists, especially in women, war, and security, or gender and militarism, or gender and war, there is a temptation to think that the chief relevance of gender analysis is in impacts, right? And of course, it's needed. I mean, before any aid package is put together, before any peacekeeping mandate is drafted, you better look and see what are going to be the impacts on men and the impacts on women and the impact on boys and the impacts on girls, and all four, by the way. And doing that is not usually done. So doing gendered impact analysis before the policy is funded is really crucial. But being a feminist analysis means you look at causation. And you look at, well, what is the cause for the militarization of security? What is the cause for the imagining that the deployment of militaries is a solution for an otherwise diplomatic problem? So I actually think, Cynthia and I talk about this a lot, when she and I email, I always line mine as the other Cynthia. Cynthia Coburn's the real deal and the other Cynthia. But we talk about this a lot because do causal analysis. It doesn't mean that the constructions and wieldings of masculinities, differentiated masculinities, and the wieldings of femininities will be, you'll find it's the main causal factor, but it may be more important than anybody's willing to admit. And that is genuine feminist analysis, is don't just let somebody convince you that gender analysis is only relevant on impacts or consequences. Because what has driven so many of us and made us feminists is that we've realized that it's the wieldings of gender that causes things that you don't want. It causes patriarchy.
Yeah. I mean, one of the discussions that we had in class after reading that piece has been about whether there's also a kind of a general, even amongst feminist-inspired students and staff, if there's a reluctance to put all of our serious eggs in one basket in relation to really centering gender. There's something very uncomfortable about believing in gender as a primary cause, even if it's amongst others.
Yeah.
As the basis for conflict, war, and insecurity. So it's quite depressing, actually.
It is.
Partly because we oscillate between treating gender as a concept, as a theoretical tool, but then also experiencing gender on a very personal and intimate level.
Absolutely.
So if somebody, you know, then writes in the title, Cynthia was very bold about it, and she said she hasn't, you know, she doesn't know what she thinks about what the next step is in the analysis, but there is something, you know, reading Gender Relations as Causal and War is both kind of, you know, exciting and provocative and liberating, but at the same time it's also quite...
It scares people.
Yeah, it is.
It scares people. I mean, Cynthia said she got more... I don't know if she called it hate mail, but it was very vociferous opposition to that piece. Was it in The Guardian?
She'd also written a piece in The Guardian.
Yeah, I think it was a co-authored piece in The Guardian. And she said the responses she got were really, if they weren't hate mail, they were hateful. And because she had really said something that's so intimate to all of us could be distorted in ways that could cause terrible harm. And that people really don't want to hear that.
Yeah.
They'd rather hear that, you know, the corporations are the source, as if corporations weren't gendered.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right?
Yeah. Okay, good reason for me to continually keep Cynthia Coburn's article
yes,
on my
absolutely.
Reading list, I feel like. That's been verified. Okay. So one of the other issues that has come up specifically... in relation to gender and militarization more generally, but especially in relation to the Women, Peace, and Security agenda, is that there's been a much more recent attention to men and boys as victims of sexual violence in conflict. But I guess I want to ask you to sort of comment on that, but also to think about whether we need different gender analytical frameworks, whether we need different conceptual frameworks to understand men and boys' experiences, whether we need kind of coordinated analytical frameworks to understand both. What do we do with these different gendered experiences of sexual violence?
Let me start with something really mundane, because I've been in the midst of this. I was at a meeting in Amsterdam. This was last year. And it was really because it was a lot of NGOs. And, you know, how many of you have worked for some kind of NGO or been an intern or been a something or a something or a something, right? You know, pouring the coffee or whatever one does to keep an NGO going. And you all know, and you should tell everybody else in the room, everything depends on donors, right? Donors drive NGO agendas. It's one of the things that is very disturbing. It's heartening that there are donors out there that are willing to support a lot of progressive organizations, but it also can be very warping. And so the discussion in Amsterdam, where there were very few academics, they were mostly NGO people, and it was a big discussion about the Dutch Women, Peace, and Security agenda, the Dutch government's, which is now quite a conservative, middle-center-right government. Still better than, you know, what the Americans called socialist, right? But, you know, in Dutch terms, it looked quite conservative. And so it was really interesting because they were calling for more input from women's groups around the world on the Dutch National Action Plan for 1325. That was the setting. And a number of feminist-informed NGOs said, we are under such pressure now from our donors to prioritize the study projects on men and boys and on masculinities. And what they said, and this is now donor talk, it's the new hot item on the block. And if you're an NGO... you are constantly trying to mind read and listen between the lines, or maybe listen to the bold print of your donor. And so a number of groups who really have as their main mission, the thing that really drives them, gives them energy, is concern about women and girls and about patriarchy and about sexism, right, and relationships between men and boys and women and girls, that relationship, are now being tantalized with the budget of the donor to move away and to look at the understudied Now imagine this, the understudied men and boys. You're at LSE, right? I mean, how many of your courses are really men's studies? Right? I don't know, what, 80%? They don't call themselves that, but they're all men's studies. So that's part of this item right now. And when people talk to me about it, and it's also happening in academia, and it's happening in other centers as well, I think my response is never take off your feminist glasses, because your feminist glasses are what allow you not just to see, but to see a question about, well, what is the relationship between masculinities as learned by boys, as enforced by men, or as aspired to constantly by some men, in its relationship to women and to girls. That saying that masculinities are interesting, that's not new to feminists. Right? What is, I think, worrisome, I almost said dangerous, but at least worrisome, is to imagine that the study of masculinities and the experiences of men and boys needs to have their own spotlight, as if they haven't had their spotlight for lo these many years. Mm-hmm. What is so innovative about women, peace, and security, what is so innovative about feminist studies, is to say that women actually are interesting. They're not angels. Women aren't interesting because they're all got halos over their heads. They're all brave. They're all courageous. They're not. You know. They're interesting. That you can't make sense of men's lives unless you watch the relationship of women in their lives. You can't make sense to a single male-dominated law firm unless you ask about the wives of those lawyers, and most of those lawyers have wives, right? And so that's what I think is risky about, you know, it's, again, the single spotlight, as you say, that is very risky, that you move around the stage. Oh, that's old. Old means 20 years of doing research. Let's move to this. That's new and hot and will get you donor money or grant money or something. And so I would urge everybody is, of course, pay attention to masculinities. Of course, watch the relationship between boys and girls within the same family or the same extended household or the same refugee camp. Of course. But not so that you no longer find interesting, intellectually demanding, trying to make sense of women's lives and girls' lives. But donors will hold the money up in front of you, right? Because they get tired easily. You know, they're just like Sesame Street watchers. You know, every 2 minutes.
They need a nap?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is connected with this, and then I have a question, a slightly more radical question about gender theories and concepts more generally. But I read a recent paper by Morten Boas and Ingen Bjorkaug from NUPI in Norway. And one of the things that they argue in this paper is that there has been this perhaps over-focus, for example, on sexual violence in the DRC. And then there has also been, that over-focus has focused on women as victims and men, democratic Congolese men as perpetrators. And one of the things they argue is that there's really been very little research done on the potential of prevention programs.
Yes, right.
Right. So that we don't actually know what kinds of successes, failures, mm-hmm. prevention programs have. And for part of their paper, they did research with fathers in the Democratic Republic of Congo, asking them. I mean, their attempt is not to center men's experiences over women's experiences, but to try and understand what are the issues facing men in relation to possible prevention strategies that they can develop. It's really interesting. I mean, what do you think that prevention programs and looking at masculinity in relation to prevention rather than only in relation to the perpetration of violence might be one area that we could expand on.
I think prevention is, first of all, in empirical terms, it's very hard to study the negative, right? So don't go down the quant road, right? Because you can't, it's very hard to study prevention because it means you'd have to know what the outcome was so you could tell it wasn't happening. You know, that's really, but I think you're absolutely right on in thinking that interest in the prevention of anything that is patriarchal, right? The prevention of sexual harassment in the workplace or in schools, the prevention of sexist behavior within job hiring interviews, the prevention of the wielding of sexism to keep the glass ceiling in place is really interesting. And so to add to that, the prevention of the perpetration, usually by men, almost overwhelmingly by men, because most, you know, now there's also a lot of new interest in the sexual violence wielded against men. There's a big program in Uganda, and it's gotten a lot of attention. And it's very male-centric, because, yes, the men who are being assaulted sexually are still being assaulted by the same men that usually assault women. So the perpetrators have stayed pretty much the same. And I think it's really quite interesting because one of the things one could do, and I haven't thought about this enough, but one of the things one could do is in prevention is ask, well, where are women in men's lives, right? And what kind of categories of women do men who are sent on peacekeeping operations or men who are enlisted in militias or in government paramilitaries, because it's not all just formal uniformed soldiers, male soldiers. Where are the women in their lives and how do they imagine women? Because one of the few things we do know from some of the perpetrators of sexual violence who've actually been willing to talk is that they have in their heads, so much of, you know, patriarchy is mental and then acted out, is they have categories of they're the good women, and then they're the women who are throwaway women, and they deserve nothing, right? I mean, that's certainly amongst the ISIS fighters. You can see that they really have these very rigid categories of who's a good woman, and that's, you know, three women that they know, and then every other woman who deserves no respect, no dignity, no protection at all. And it would be very interesting to actually, and that would be something with all the skills that the center has on gender analysis, could do a kind of interviewing, mapping kind of, that you would have to have feminist skills to be able to do. Because my worry is that some of the people who are now calling for, rightly, and devising prevention programs still have no feminist curiosity. And so they really wouldn't know what questions to ask, what kinds of imaginations they need to plumb to get at some of these things.
Yeah, there is still this kind of ongoing sort of satellite system of men's organizations, which is... you know, which is also politically strategic, but then it has its negative effects. Chris Dolan often, for example,
and
some
that's
of the work,
Uganda.
Yeah, some of the work he's been doing, for example, has, you know, he finds at times the need to sort of align himself with feminist organizations, but at other times distance himself. And I think that that shows how difficult it is to work in isolation from a larger feminist project.
Exactly right. Yeah. I think that's so true.
Okay, well, that links me to my last question, and then I'd like to turn it over to the audience to ask you some questions and have a conversation this way. But actually, my last question is a little bit of a radical question, because I
now we're getting to hear what Marcia Henry thinks is radical.
I think the choice of the word radical shows my age a little bit, because I think what I think is radical is probably not very... It's not radicalization. But, well, I was actually just thinking that, you know, we've been talking primarily about men and women as fairly distinct categories and labels. And so really I was thinking about really the LGBT question and sort of trying to shift the heteronormative framework of much of what we do and a lot of scholars do. And I was just thinking, you know, would it be, you know, as Marija Zaleski always says, you know, gender is a problem. Let's just get rid of gender. Let's get rid of gender and all our problems would go away. And so I was just thinking about, you know, the role of gender as a way of, you know, the problems that come with gender in terms of how it also can be used to stabilize fixed norms about what women should look like, what women should do, who is a victim, who is a perpetrator, and men as well. And so I'm thinking about subjects that don't fit into those categories or don't want to fit into those categories and how they might be affected in situations of conflict and war. You know, are they are their voices and their accounts invisible? Should they be made visible, or does that make them more vulnerable? Lots of questions there.
But that's why you have a center, not just an hour conversation. Well, I think a couple of things is that patriarchal genderings are an attempt at imposing rigidity on something that is fluid. Gender is not in and of itself rigid. It is patriarchal impositions on messy, fluid, dynamic gender understandings, personal and interpersonal, that makes it rigid. So, I mean, one of the first, well, not first, but in the 1980s, when some of the best, not the last, but some of the best feminist historiography was being done. Fabulous, fabulous stuff, cross-national. And there was, for the first time, discussions of tomboys, right? And taking seriously when a girl wants to climb trees. That was the classic, right? When a girl wants to climb trees, who tells her not to climb trees? And it's usually her mother, right? Mm-hmm. When a girl wants to wear pants to school, who usually says, no, dear, you know, you really need to wear a dress to school? It's usually her mother. And it was a history, though, of understandings of this category called tomboys. But that's all a study of the fluidity, and some people are tomboys forever, you know. Tomboy isn't just a stage of life. But it really says that feminists have been curious about, not been the rigid cookie-cutter people. Feminists have said, well, that's the thing about gender, is it is so messy, it is so fluid, it is so dynamic, and that can be studied, and then watch who is most afraid of that, who is made, if you will, most insecure by that fluidity, by that porousness, by that messiness. And so I think in wartime, well, and you know this so well, Marcia, but in wartime, there are two things going on at the same time. On the one hand, all kinds of policing, in the broadest sense of policing, all kinds of policing systems break down. Families get separated. One of the biggest policing mechanisms get broken up. People get displaced from communities, and they can be something. They may be impoverished, they may be scared out of their wits, but they can be something new because they're not in their own home village anymore and nobody knows them, right? And the third thing, well, third out of probably 50, but the third thing that happens that kind of breaks down the gender policing systems is the need of governments and employers to replace usually men and boys who've been enlisted or forced not only into state militaries but into militias to fight. And therefore, girls have to, you know, there's the have to be able to repair the bus, right? I mean, there's the famous photograph in the Imperial War Museum of the very young Princess Elizabeth repairing a truck, right? So wartime militarized violence can break down policing systems around gender. But at the same time, there's more desire than ever to reimpose gender boxes for the sake of preserving this so-called nation, whatever, or preserving the ethnic community, usually in quotes. I'm very suspicious of community as an enforcement mechanism. I think it's one's got to really watch who wields community, right? And also, of course, there is the military, which is a gender regimenting system. And women who are brought into either militaries or meant to be military wives or military girlfriends or forced wives, sex slaves. And that's all. So you've got these two things going on at the same time, which means that gender is so much the arena of contests for power. So I think that's why refugee camps or refugees, whether they're in camps or fending on their own, become so important to understand. You know, how does a girl learn new skills that her mother is embarrassed she now knows, right? Does her father think she'll never be marriageable now? That's what happened to, my understanding is from oral histories, that's what happened to a lot of teenage girls who fought with the Zimbabwean forces, both ZAPU and ZANU, is they were considered by mothers of boys in the post-war era, so this would be in the 70s, as not marriageable. That is, they didn't want their son to marry a young woman who had spent her teenage years with the rebel forces because she wasn't a good girl anymore. Right? She didn't fit the "she'd be a good wife for my good son." Yeah. Right? So, more to study, more to do.
Okay, I could talk with you all night, but I won't hog you anymore. So, I would like to open it up for other people to ask questions and start. Yes, please.
Tell me your name, just so I...
My name is Hilary Stauffer, and I'm actually a visiting fellow.
Oh, great. Hi, Hilary.
It's such an honor. You're invigorating.
Too short. I'm too short.
I was very curious, something you mentioned right at the beginning of your talk about the bureaucratization of the WPS agenda. Mm-hmm. And obviously we had a big review just yesterday at the UN.
Yes, right.
Resolution 2242 got passed. There's something particular in that resolution about increasing the number of female peacekeepers by 50% over the next 5 years. Without any additional resources.
Of course.
This is a very broad question. Is that generally good, generally bad, or generally a good
thing? It's generally suspicious, I think. There are some people in very well-meaning but untutored spirit who really do believe that if you can somehow demasculinize militarized peacekeeping, that you will have more effective peacekeeping, right? And I don't think that really takes seriously enough how effective the militarization of women as soldiers can be. right? You can militarize any of us. I mean, hopefully some of us are a little harder to militarize than others, and that's mainly because you've worked with Marsha Henry and you're hanging out together and you're interested in the center, and so you've got more resistance, but look out, you know. So I think some of that comes from really a genuine, but I think untutored set of expectations. The more worrisome is that some people think it's the quick fix. So they don't have to change anything. They don't have to. They certainly don't have to change their funding of peacekeeping. They don't have to change their militaries. They don't have to change their peacekeeping missions. They don't have to pay any more attention to local feminist groups. They're not going to bring them into the room. They're just going to have, you know, more uniformed women peacekeepers from Bangladesh and Ghana and Fiji. And that is really dangerous, because it will look as though it's the quick fix, what other people call the magic bullet. Watch. It's so hard to clean up your language. Like, you know, how do you get out of the trenches? How do you get out of the front line? How, you know, really, we're all so corrupted.
Well, they've just been reading, in my class, they've just been reading Carol Cohn's.
Oh, good. Okay.
I want to say seminal piece, but
yes,
I won't
do
that.
No, you won't.
Ovular piece.
Carol would be very pleased. Carol
so they've
great.
Been very sensitized yes. to language this
great.
Week.
And so the real worry is that some people will think that's an either-or proposal or project, and that by increasing the number of women in uniform, because they now will be in state militaries, right, that means they don't have to have any local feminists in the room, which is actually the main thing that 1325 is calling for, right? That local, rooted, grassroots women, civil society activists have to be in the decision-making room. And that will be the last bastion. That will be the hardest thing. And if this is used as an alternative to that, it will be awful. Yeah. One really should watch what they think. Is it an add-on? And is that still dismissing how women in those forces are going to get trained, otherwise known as militarized? Right. Will they be less racist? Will they be less likely to use their weapons? Will they be less likely to see themselves as civilized because they're the peacekeepers in an uncivilized realm? I'm not so sure. Depends, maybe maybe the provision should be that every woman who's enlisted into a state military that is then sent on a UN peacekeeping mission has to have a best friend who's a feminist. And if those women would do,
you have to get a reference from a feminist in your job application.
Yeah, right. It was in there, I'm sure.
Can I just say something
in addition to that?
Partly yes. Because, there's three things that I think are linked with that. One would be, you know, that you know this, that an ongoing issue has been whether adding women to the military, whether integrating women in the military makes them more operationally effective. I think this line of thinking is really getting quite, it's been debunked, I think, substantially by a number of
it's
scholars.
It's still appealing.
Yeah,
it's
it is.
Very
so
appealing.
I think at the policy and practice level, it's quite appealing.
Yeah.
It's appealing to the U.S. administration in particular. But I think in relation to peacekeeping, you have another kind of paradox, which is that, well, if you use the equality argument that, you know, everyone should have equal access to participate in a state employer, then there should be more women peacekeepers because it's a state institution, it's a good civil service job. But then what do you do about their deployment? So the third actually issue is really to do with men getting reference letters from feminist friends as well. So we could have that, you know, because what I came across in my own research was that there are so many male peacekeepers who actually have gender expertise. They've been working in, for example, the sexual sexual crimes divisions, so the police peacekeepers. They had all this expertise. No one asked them.
Oh,
they
wow.
weren't sent there because they had
no
that expertise.
Kidding.
They were just sent because they were
wow.
male and they were police officers.
Wow.
So we're not harnessing, you know, and then the second yes. point, to go back in reverse, is that the women that they send
yes.
often have, as you just outlined, the highest sort of weapons training, and they actually have the least training in relation to things like women's security or family and domestic issues.
Absolutely.
So we have a kind of whole topsy-turvy sort of situation where we could be actually, you know, encouraging the recruitment of peacekeepers into peacekeeping missions that were more feminist-informed,
yeah.
more gender experts, and a better balance. So we could have all three, but it seems like they're starting from the
yeah.
from the opposite end.
And they're leaving in place as if we already know what peacekeeping is.
Yeah.
And whereas if you really rethought peacekeeping, you'd have to rethink skills. And they don't really want to, they, whoever they are, don't really want to rethink skills. And you put your finger right on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, more questions?
Thoughts? Stories?
Yes?
First of all, say thank you. I cited maneuvers quite extensively.
Oh, gosh.
When I was writing my undergrad thesis. So
oh, gosh.
21-year-old me thanks you a lot.
Oh, that's so nice. That's so nice. Tell me your name.
Say who you are.
I'm Lauren. I'm in the Gender Development and Globalization Program here at
LSE. Oh, great.
And in Gender and Alterization with Dr. Henry.
Oh, great.
So my thesis was actually on gender-based violence, domestic violence specifically in post-conflict societies.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And so you touched upon this briefly towards the end. That conflict can have sort of a transformative, at least briefly, role in society. And women often participate in it, either directly or as a byproduct, as a way to sort of change the way the fabric of their society is built in terms of the oppression of women.
Mm-hmm.
But what you find is even if they're quite instrumental in bringing about the end to the conflict or peace, that peace is wielded against them in order to disregard their issues, to stop conflict, to disarm, and to reintegrate soldiers or paramilitaries into civil society.
Yeah.
So I guess I'd just like to hear more of your thoughts on sort of how we can increase women's participation in these processes, either because they are also reintegrating or because they are being reintegrated back into.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that's, and this is why the center is being launched at a very particular moment in the gendered history of these sorts of discussions and investigations, and that is there's increasing understanding that post-conflict, post-war goes on a long time, and it is profoundly gendered and usually is deeply patriarchal. Because if, as you've just suggested, if post-war is a time to go back to normal, right, that leaves no doors and windows open for those things that did change in the midst of conflict. Not that you fight wars so that you can have Rosie the Riveter, right? Rosie should have been able to learn how to be a high-paid welder in 1935, right? Not just in 1942. But if there have been any kind of mobilization of women, new skills learned by women, new expectations learned by girls, they should be carried forward at the very time when a lot of the masculinized policymakers really see post-war as going back to normal. And therefore, anything that is considered socially destabilizing is seen as not in the name of peace. And I think, let me direct you again to Alison Smith's dissertation here. Well, truly, no, really, about why that has not happened in Rwanda. Why that rollback has been resisted mightily and quite effectively. Rwandan feminists would say not totally effectively, but quite effectively in Rwanda. And why? And Alison, get her afterwards here in the lavender jacket again. So she will tell you why it's not because Paul Kagame is a feminist. Right? But it does, one of the things that is happening as a result of your insights as well as others is that it means that now more and more civil society women's groups, whether they call themselves feminists or not, who may not be in the peace negotiation room but are outside and monitoring it and finding ways to channel some kind of lobbying inside, are really trying to draw up a post-war model and not let the peace negotiation stop with the putting down of arms. And if you look, if you're trying to track the Colombian, for instance, and everybody's talking to each other, right? Because one of the good things is now there's a lot of transnational feminist sharing of lessons, right? And so look at the Colombian women's rights people expectations of what's going to happen in Havana, and they've pushed it further and further into the post-war so that that kind of reversal can't happen. But of course the power is behind the reversal, right? Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Okay, others?
Aiko?
Yeah, hi.
My name's Aiko. I'm a doctoral student here at the Gender Institute.
Hi, Aiko.
And before that, I used to work in an NGO.
Oh, yeah?
Decaf.
Thank you,
not just for the talk, but for the endless inspiration.
Oh.
For me and I think so many others. And I wanted to ask a question about something that you wrote in the new verse.
Yes.
And it's something that's kind of haunted both my work as a practitioner and now my research. The question of whether femocrats are being co-opted by the state,
right,
or whether they're transforming it. And you kind of point to the notion that we need to investigate under what conditions. And as somebody who's worked a lot with military institutions, and now I'm interested in kind of the efforts,
yes,
that are ongoing with this idea of gender training to try and transform, mm-hmm, and what that might look like. And I was wondering if you could expand a little bit on this kind of the potential and the dangers in engaging with state institutions in particular.
Yeah, Aiko, that's so good, because processes are so interesting to investigate, aren't they? And co-optation is a process, right? And so you've read the work on Australia, right? The femocrats, which is the first, I think it was one of the Australians were the first to use the term, Australian feminists, who under four prime ministers ago, it's going to come to us, really progressive labor Party prime minister in Australia in the 80s, so maybe five.
Keating. Christine's down there saying,
well, who,
were,
oh,
you, hi, in Australia? Christine, hi. Hi. So, were you in Australia then?
Yeah, it's, say, yes, yes. Well, it wouldn't have been Hawke. It wouldn't have been Hawke, yes, right. And so it was, you know, your folks. It was, it was Australian feminists who first coined the term femocrats, which has sitting right in the middle, it's no hyphens or anything, right in the middle of femocrats is a tension. And the tension is, so are you going to be more crat than fem, right? And but what's so interesting is that the first study of femocrats really said those who are most able to keep their original motivation for joining the state as feminist activists outside the state was the ones who were most able to keep that original motivation were those who kept very close kind of daily, weekly ties, friendships, relationships with independent feminist groups. Those who were most prone to being sucked in to the crat part, and they may be doing good work in public health. They may be doing good work in food security. They may be doing good work in tax reform, right? It's not that they then become evil. It's just that they lose that cutting-edge, motivating, feminist drive because they lost touch. They became careerist, right? And this is, of course, This happens in academia, right? It's, I've often said to myself first and then said out loud, never be the most feminist person you know. Right? Amongst your friends, make sure you are not your most feminist of all your friends, right? Always have somebody who really is, you know. For me, it's Cynthia Coburn. You know, I'm just never going to measure up, you know. I mean, truly, she knows I think that. That process of co-optation is something to really be investigated. And it has to be investigated kind of in real time, because usually co-optation is most effective when you don't know you're being co-opted. All of a sudden, things that you used to think were strange don't seem strange anymore. That's one clue. You start using a shorthand, and you forget you're using shorthand, right? You know, you start talking in acronyms or whatever. And you begin to think that tenure requirements are reasonable, you know. I mean, all kinds of things that you begin to think. And so I think studying co-optation, finding a research methodology to study co-optation is really interesting. Sometimes it would be interviewing people who have resigned. And sometimes people resign exactly at the moment where they think, oh my God, I'm about to lose my soul. I got to get out of here, right? But people who've been in for a long time, it's harder for any of us to be reflective enough. Right? But still, it'd be worth it. I'll give you the name of somebody who is most conscious of this and is really trying to do the good work in militaries, and that's Charlotte Isaacson. Charlotte Isaacson, who is now seconded to the NATO headquarters in Belgium. And she's a civilian. She's not a career military uniform person. And she is so conscious every hour of every day. Am I slipping? I'm supposed to be making, get it, NATO more gender aware. Am I just making NATO more skilled at the instrumentalization of gender? And how can you tell which you are? Right? I have a Pakistani feminist economist friend who's now teaching at a very prestigious institution in Pakistan. And she says, am I slipping? Am I beginning to argue that you should pay attention for women because you won't have economic growth without women? That's the equivalent. That's the equivalent of women. You better have women at the checkpoints because only women can search other women. In economics, it's you'll only have national growth if you make the full use of women's economic potential. You know, feels good. People listen to you that haven't listened before. So I study co-optation, right? Including yourself. You know.
Would you say that that's also true on the other, potentially the other end of the political spectrum? I remember a story from a Colombian colleague of mine when I was doing my PhD of, you know, extreme left radical organizations. Wow. That's when I can use the word radical.
Yes.
Appropriate. Radical organizations who were working to improve women's lives, and where these organizations had become, in a sense, so militarized.
Yes.
In their attempts to fight patriarchy, fight, heteronormativity and capitalism, that, you know, at one feminist workshop, somebody brought out a gun, you know, because people were not cooperating and acting in a collective manner. And I think that, you know, you have the femocrats and the bureaucrats on kind of potentially one end, but you also have this. So I think, you know,
yes.
I think you've said this in many different contexts of your work, but women are fighting for authority and to be recognized in places where power relations are so starkly sort of evident. So in all these spaces, it's difficult to be seen as authentic and be authentic to one's own ethical framework, as well as try and make some sort of political transformation.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason I wrote that first chapter, I guess it was, in Seriously, is because I'd watched myself do it. You know, I'd watched myself in faculty meetings trying to get somebody to take seriously something I was saying about a very good younger faculty member who deserved promotion. And I watched myself make an argument. And the argument was so that the guys around the table would take my urging about this younger faculty colleague seriously. But the argument was just, there she goes, you know, just, I mean, they listened, of course, because it would strengthen the already patriarchal institution. Right? And then you find yourself making that. So it is, it's really, I mean, don't become paralyzed by, right? But become, I mean, you are, you know, if you're at all feminist, you are already reflective. Just keep notes as to when you watch yourself on the verge of being co-opted into something you don't want to be co-opted into. And just write it down so that you can hear what it was like, right? And then go study it in others.
We might be playing back this recording. I don't wish that on the Center for Women, Peace, and Security at all, but it's good to have wise words echoing. I think we have time for one more question.
Sure.
But then I said that I would leave the last 10 minutes for people to come up if they want to have things on. Yes, please.
Yes, hi. My name is Dina. I'm also doing a master's
here. Oh, hi,
Dina. International Migration and Public Policy.
Oh, excellent.
And I would like to hear your views on sort of talk a bit more about transnational feminism and the kind of, I'm coming from a more practical and perhaps advocacy.
Yes, sure. In refugee work especially, yourself?
Yeah, or student politics as well.
Yes, oh, good.
But just a kind of anxiety that I kind of feel is happening in transnational feminism, being wanting to listen and hear different kinds of women's stories and advocate for their rights whilst also sort of not talking for them. And this kind of balance that I feel is so difficult to master, being a feminist and wanting to be engaged in other people's lives, but then also not talking above their heads and being
exactly
very delicate in the listening process. And I think you should talk more about listening, and that's something that you've talked more about in your work, and I found that really inspiring, and taking women's lives seriously, but then how do you always do that?
And make a case someplace. Yes, I think it's one of the things that makes efforts at transnational feminists. It's always, again, it's a process, right? So the ongoing effort to be transnational in one's feminism and one's feminist advocacy work, especially, as you say, will always have this tension within it. And in fact, if there isn't a tension, one's not a genuinely transnational feminist, or not generally feminist in one's transnational work. That is, if the rubber band feels slack, you've lost it, right? So the bad news is that difficulty should never go away. The good news is that shows that one's doing feminist work because you feel the tension, whereas a lot of other people are advocates, well-meaning, even times risk-taking advocates. Non-feminists in Amnesty, non-feminists in Human Rights Watch, non-feminists in Refugees International. And they don't feel the tension. Right? So that's not the magic answer, but it says keep the tension alive so that one constantly tries to figure out, well, how to do that? I mean, is it always that you fly the women from the northeast of Thailand to the meeting and make sure they get at the table? Or is it that you make your reports, make sure you have lots of direct quotes in your reports? I'm very suspicious of reports that have almost no direct quotes, or they put the direct quotes only, as Joni Seeger says, in a box on the side, right? The famous box on the side, because she's a transnational feminist environmental activist, and she says that's what all the big international environment reports now, they're now embarrassed that they don't have any gender analysis anywhere, and their solution has been put women in the box, right? And that makes the page look more lively, and you know, but actually to integrate it into the text of the report and its recommendations so that those women's voices are not just fodder for the agency or the NGO, but are actually part of the education for the reader and the audience. But yes, the tension should never go away. Too bad.
I kind of realized that.
Yes, I know you did. I could tell.
Okay, I think we have to stop, but I just, before thanking Cynthia, I do want to just say one of the reasons why we came up with this conversations series is
fun.
Partly because, and I'm not saying don't visit this site on LSE, yeah. but we have a thing that comes up on the main webpage, which is called Gearty's Grillings. And that's Connor Gearty, who's in the Center for Human Rights, our colleagues. And but the grillings are a little bit conventional in that he grills, analytically, theoretically grills, various academics.
Sounds militarized to me.
So I thought this might be an alternative way. I think we should still have grillings.
Yeah.
But I think we should definitely have lots more conversations. I think they're much more open-ended. This isn't closed by any means. So thank you so much for participating. And thank you very much to the audience for your questions
absolutely.
And your comments. Okay.
Thank you.